In her first ever graphic memoir, four-time Emmy-winning comedy writer Meryl Marco unearths her treasured diaries, long kept under lock and key, to illustrate the hilarious story of her preteen and teen years and how she came to realize that her secret power was her humor. Her new book is We Saw Scenery, the earliest diaries of Meryl Marco. Marco's storied career in comedy has included co-creating and serving as head writer for Late Night with David Letterman, earning her three of her four Emmys and giving the world stupid pet tricks in the bargain. She's also published much-loved collections of her comic essays and three novels, as well as her cartoons having been featured in The New Yorker. Earlier this year, Marco received the prestigious Patty Chayefsky Laurel Award for Television Writing Achievement. Again, the new book is We Saw Scenery, The Earliest Diaries of Meryl Marco. And it is Meryl Marco who we welcome to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Give me a sense of how this came about. The way it is illustrated in the book is that you come across these diaries. So at what point then did you say, oh, there's something here that I could talk about and in this graphic format?
When I found them again, I mean, I knew I was saving them, but I hadn't seen them in a long time because they were at the bottom of a box of stuff I save. And I save a ton of stuff because I always think it's something I can use somehow to write comedy from, even though most of it really ends up not being anything you can use at all. It's just when something makes me laugh, I save it because I'm grateful, I guess. I don't know. Anyway... I found them, and the first thought I had about them was how funny it was that the earliest ones, I started keeping a diary when I was in fourth grade. It was a present, like a birthday present from my mother, and they had those early ones had a lock and a key, which made me laugh because I was thinking, what in the world was I writing when I was 10 that really, you know, needed to be sheltered from the light of day like that? So I thought, well, it would be funny to sit down and read them like they're a piece of literature because, you know, they actually do analyze the diaries of, say, Ernest Hemingway or someone, and they see the early moments of a storied career, et cetera. And so I thought, well, okay, it would be funny to just analyze them like that. And I'll just read them from cover to cover and see what they are as a book. But that didn't happen because they were so jarring in a way that made me want to analyze them because it was an entirely different version of me, a girl who really didn't remind me particularly much of me, although some of it I remembered having happened, but lots of it I didn't. And I started wondering about memory, you know, and I started doing a little research into that. Originally, I thought what I might do was take the funnier pages and make them into like a comic strip. So it would be a comic strip written by an 11-year-old in another era. And I would illustrate it without judgment because I started to want to see what it looked like, especially the stuff that I didn't remember, including the stuff I did remember. I guess this is how my memory works. I'm assuming everybody's memory. I have like a flash of it, but not really a very fleshed out flash of it. So I thought it would be funny to just kind of see it in some kind of bigger context. And then also the other thing that was interesting to me about it was that when my mother gave me these diaries, I didn't know what a diary was exactly. She explained it to me that you write down stuff, but I didn't know what you were supposed to write down. So I had figured out two things. One, I thought I was supposed to write something on every page. And I tried to do that, and lots of times I would forget for like a week, and then I'd go back, and I'd fill in pages writing, nothing happened, can't remember what happened, nothing particular happened, to make sure that I had at least committed to adding something to the page. But after that, I didn't really know what I was writing, so I was just writing down literally everything. And that, which is so not the way a more sophisticated person keeps a diary, and therefore was funny to me. Like I'd write down what television shows I watched and what happened on them, and or what tests we were having in school, or like if I got in a fight with my parents, sometimes it was there verbatim, which I thought was really interesting. You know, the back and the forth, And so I thought, well, these would be really funny to draw. So that was how I started doing it, is I started just drawing the ones I thought were evocative. And then soon I had a pile of them. And when I had a big enough pile of them, I showed them to some friends who were saying, well, this is a book. And I was saying, well, how is it a book? It's just random. It's the random events of a kid. A kid who didn't particularly remind me of me, by the way. I mean, I know it was me, but, you know, she was missing all of the wily defense mechanisms I picked up since. She was just kind of doddering through. and anyway, that's so I kept drawing these things and trying to figure out how they were a book. And eventually I had enough of them that I showed a version of it to a publisher who said she'd publish it. And then I really had to figure out how it was a book. So I started to really layer it. And because I felt like it still needed a way in for other people. I didn't want it to just be a masturbatory effort where it was just, and then I did this, and then I did that, and then I did this, and then, you know, so I was trying to make it more universal. And also it occurred to me as I was doing it that I was pretty typical, you know, like what I've heard from my friends, at least, is it's pretty easy to identify with, because there's nothing all that special about the stuff I was doing and thinking. It's just that it's there in detail from another era. So that seemed interesting to me.
You write very early in the book about what you were just talking about, the disconnect. You say, when I finally decided to sit down and read them, I was amazed at how much it felt like I was reading about a stranger. So you had to come to terms with that. And then you come to terms with what your, and there's a lot in the book about the hippocampus, but of what your brain decides that it's going to remember and what it doesn't.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, is that it doesn't remember everything, obviously. Because, you know, I think of, before I read the diary, if I think about fifth grade, I get sort of an impression of fifth grade. I see the teacher, I see a class, maybe I got a thing or two, you know, but I don't really have a day-to-day recounting of fifth grade, but I do now, you know. So it was just, that was kind of interesting to me, is the fact that I could actually tell you what happened in fifth grade in detail that year in the early 60s at some point. And it's like a world that's not so different than this world, but it's also different. You know, it's sort of about the continuity of life in a lot of ways, because things don't really change. Lately, I've been watching a show on Hulu called Pen 15. Have you seen that?
I have. Yeah,
I think it's pretty brilliant, but there's real overlap with the same age of me in my diaries. And these girls are writing about 10, 15. They're writing about being 13 in the 90s, and I'm writing about being 13 in the 60s. And it's pretty damn near the same stuff. You know, we didn't have portable phones, but we had, you know, we had every parallel thing. It's just kind of interesting to me that a lot of this stuff is set, you know, it just remains the same. I mean, we didn't have climate change, but I was really worried about the ozone layer, which was essentially the same.
Yes. You have there's a part of the book where you're talking to the hippo, the hippocampus, of course, and you say, why'd you leave all that stuff out? And the hippo says, well, you were too young and self-absorbed to notice. You should be thanking me. It just makes you look bad. And that sort of permeates a lot of this of what, as I said, of what you choose to remember, what you weren't remembering. And then you come to terms of that. Did it help you remember things?
Yeah, totally. Well, yes, it helped me remember things. But as I was analyzing, you know, it's funny with memory. When you see a thing, you remember some stuff. And then I couldn't tell as I was writing about it whether I was resupplying it with details because I was writing about it, or if they were really the actual details that come from it. You know, you can never fully know that. In fact, three of my friends were recounting a particular incident, and it took all three of us to bring the memory forward. And I thought, well, yeah, three people's perspective on it would give you a lot more about what you're talking about. You get the one, so especially when you're a kid, you get one self-absorbed weird memory. Like the thing I'm thinking about right now is when I was fourth grade to sixth grade, I was always in love with somebody. And by love, I mean I thought they were cute. And there was really no other dimension to it. It was completely about being cute. And knowing nothing about them, by the way, maybe and having very little interaction with them, but love nonetheless, as I saw it. So I was really in love with a Nazi for fourth grade to sixth grade. And I didn't realize when I ran into that in the diary, I remembered it because I remembered writing it down, but I was flattered by the fact that he would go Heil Hitler when he saw me. I thought that meant he thought I was interesting and he was paying attention to me. It didn't occur to me that he was Jew baiting me and that it was like an ultimate insult. It just never occurred to me. And that's how completely dingy I was at 10 or 11, even though it wasn't all that long after World War II and my family's Jewish. And, you know, I knew about Hitler, but, you know, somehow I didn't add up 2 and 2. I was just in love, and Nazism be damned. So that was the point in the book where as I was doing these drawings where I thought, well, I really should have a talk with this kid, you know, because I felt terrible for myself that I was such an idiot and that I had picked such a horrible love interest. I do remember he was cute. He was cute.
Yeah. So this the Jew baiting Nazi Wayne that you write about. So there are times where you draw the older you talking to the younger you. So that's where you sort of came to that idea of the wiser you
pass.
Saying, "Oh, let's have a talk."
Yeah, I just thought you can't let this just sit there. That you were in love with a Nazi, and repeatedly did I mention these things, you know, and had no negative reaction. It was just our love was growing deeper as he continued to give me the German salute. Jesus, I mean, it's horribly embarrassing, except it's also kind of interesting.
Oh, very interesting. Yes. Merrill Marco is our guest. The new book is We Saw Scenery, the early diaries of Merrill Marco, written and illustrated by Merrill Marco. It is a graphic memoir, and it's just absolutely beautiful. I'm curious.
And I do have a crush on Richard Spencer, I must say. No, I'm kidding. That's a terrible joke. Gotta love the Nazis.
Yeah.
Who doesn't love them?
Well, let me ask you the other thing that comes very clear in this book quite early. You say, by now, pop culture had become the glue that held my life together. This was in the early 60s that you write this. You start writing the diary in 1958, I believe. So as you are aware that in reading this, that of how infatuated you are with television and radio and entertainment.
Yeah, you don't really know what the story of your life is until you have to sit down and maybe collate it, because, I mean, certainly for some people who live the life of extreme adventure, that story of your life becomes completely more clear. Maybe Jane Goodall or somebody who's my idol, by the way, the story of her life is way more easy to spot than the story of my life, which I was trying to figure out. And I was realizing when I got to all those pages, you know, I ended up writing for television, and it never occurred to me that I was prepping for it my whole life. I was really obsessed with television. A lot of people will tell you, you know, they got through their childhood getting lost in books. And I did reading, but at that age, like junior high and up later grade school, I was reading mostly Nancy Drew and Mad Magazine, and I was watching a ton of television. I had the schedule memorized, and I'd watch it the minute I got home from school, and also I was seeking to interact with these shows. You know, I was like a lot of people, a lot of kids, so I was pretending I had a show in my room, but I was also reaching out to try to get involved with these shows somehow. Like I was entering every contest that they had on these shows, and I was coming in sort of second in a number of the contests. I didn't win anything, but I was a runner-up to have a chimp come to your birthday party. And I was calling a lot of radio shows because I listened to music at night. I had a transistor radio, and at night I would stay up late after I was supposed to be in bed with this transistor radio under the covers, and I was entering radio contests because they were having a lot of them. It was a real big time for AM radio. And the DJs were these celebrities to me, and I was calling in every contest. The one I had written down that I hadn't remembered at all is you had to scream the word bone jammer.
Yes.
Lord only knows what was the actual content of that. But at 11, you know, a girl who was in love with Nazis, I certainly didn't know what bone jammer meant. So I was playing along, and I was calling up all these radio stations and dedicating songs. And so I was getting very involved with pop culture. I was going to supermarket openings to meet game show and kid show hosts. And
I was just thinking that if you had won the chimp at your birthday party contest, that would have been quite an entry.
I did. They read my letter on TV, and that's an entry.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. No, it would have been a great entry. No, nothing that dramatic. The most dramatic thing that happened to me with the kids' show host was I got to ride to a shopping center with, I used to like this Creature Features kind of show that came on at night. I was also writing, by the way, my first published piece of work, which didn't make it into the diary because I had rules about this book. The rules were that I was only writing about stuff that was entered in the diary. Obviously, I have other memories, but I wasn't just going on memories. I was going on documented memories. But I have a letter that was published in Monsters, some monster magazine. I think it was, I forget what it's called right now, World of Monsters or something like that. It was a letter to the editor, a jokey letter to the editor with a picture of my brother in a mask. That was my first published work. It was pretty much the same year. I was very busy interacting with all this kind of crap pop culture. And getting on, you know, I was on at some point, like I think it was eighth or ninth grade, I was starting to be on the news because they would have a Miami teenager speaks, you know, and that would be me having called the radio station and interjecting what seemed like an opinion to me.
You end up in the limo. You win a chance to ride with this guy who was the host of The Dungeon.
And I was actually giving him a load of crap about being a guy who dresses in a monster costume and goes to shopping centers. That's what I remember. That was my idea of being charming. I had some weird ideas about being charming that year. It was the same year that I had a psychiatric stand that that was on the roadside, which I got totally from Peanuts. You know, Lucy used to set up a stand
sure.
on Peanuts. And I thought, well, there's a great way to meet boys. So I made one like that with my friend. It looked exactly like the one she had. It was a little more rickety, probably. She didn't have to worry about construction because she was a cartoon. But I was giving workshop tests to guys who would stop and just telling them they had mental problems. That was my idea of flirting. Which still makes me laugh. That's such a great idea. But I was getting all my flirting tips from Mad Magazine. So I was sort of a total, a misshapen future comedy writer is basically what I was. I used to go to joke stores and I had like one of these joy buzzers. I thought those were really great. They didn't really work as well as you wanted them to. It looked like
no.
on the drawing that you were going to hit somebody with it and it was going to be zzzz. But really all it was a kind of a little wind-up thing that went...
Wasn't nearly as good in practice. You do write about Mad Magazine. You say, I was getting all my romantic advice from Mad Magazine. This was the first but not the last time I would learn, quote, sarcasm, not a good tool for seduction.
Yeah, I was really playing the sarcasm heavy. I thought that was flirting, basically. And, you know, it doesn't actually work out so well. The men, not so, a lot of men, not so interested in the wisecracking women.
But
although they like them in movies.
I was going to say,
like
sarcasm served you well in your career.
Yeah, no, it was. I was training for what I would become, but it was certainly not apparent when I was doing it. You know, it was apparent to me as I was trying to put it together as a story. Well, geez, I was inexorably heading for TV. I didn't know I was because I went, you know, I thought I'd be an actress in high school and I went to art school. So I didn't know I was heading for TV, but I was just sort of inexorably making a beeline for it.
Mm. You basically divide the book into two parts. One is the Miami years, and then when you head out west. And there's a real shift there, isn't it? I mean, not only geographic, but in how that affects you as you get older.
I felt like at the time when I was when we moved, I thought my life was being ruined because I felt I was a made man. I was in like a secret club in junior high, and with girls who were all very, very status driven, and so was I. We were all just kind of obsessed with wearing the right clothes. We were kind of a wimpy version of the Kardashians, I guess, for that I was never able to achieve any of the our primary goal, the as I recall, the girls that I hung with all the time, was a level of undeniable cuteness that you couldn't permeate it. It would be so cute that you would just be off the charts cute, and that was pretty much it for the club, for the girls, these are people I loved, obviously, but I was immersed in that stuff. And when I moved to California, I was thrown in as an outsider, and it was right at the point, it was a great time to move to California, although I didn't see it that way. It was right on the cusp of the hippie thing. So we moved to San Francisco, and I just completely changed, and I feel like it saved my life. It threw me into a Bay Area full of weird ideas and unconventional people and reading material and artwork, and I'm eternally grateful that my parents made this move. Also, if we had remained in Florida, I'm under the impression that they're one or two people over the lunatic limit, and they can throw the earth out of its orbit at this point. Florida is so full of loons, so I had to get out. I'm glad they got me out of there, you know. The Bay Area was filtering them differently. So, I mean, they're nuts in both areas, but the Bay Area goofballs are interesting.
You do write about, your parents. You write about things that happened in your life. Once you get into California, you say, my two most reliable new California friends were depression and sarcasm.
Yeah, and I was already translating them. You know, what the book really ends up being, I realized that by the end of it, is it's a sort of a love letter to being creative, because I don't know how anybody lives without it. I mean, it just repeatedly saves me from falling into a chasm, you know. I mean, when it was sarcasm and depression, I was already using it as I was writing things. They were horrible things, but they were things that were helping me to view my life and transcend my life in an interesting way that separated me out from them and didn't allow me to sink inside of what the worst of it was. And it just is, to me, it's the greatest gift, the idea that you can use creativity to reconceive the ground rules of the way that you see what your life is. You just can reassess, you know, you're given a hand, but you can recalculate what the perimeters of that hand are and replace yourself in it based on changing the whole point of view. And it's a great magic act.
Meryl Marco is our guest this morning. Her new book is We Saw Scenery. It is a graphic memoir, the subtitle, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. We will continue our conversation with Meryl after this short break. Award-winning comedy writer Meryl Marco is with us. She's talking about her new book, We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. 1965, July 3rd, you write, I might want to write a book. The whole world seems so full of screwed up stuff, but maybe if I can charge through it, writing what I see, it will still be a meaningful life.
Yeah, that was correct.
Yeah.
I was actually making sense at that point. I didn't change so much since I was her. You know, the earliest version of me, the girl who was in love with Nazis, you know, geez. I'm not so different from the one I was at the latter part of high school, though. I mean, I've learned a lot of hard lessons, as everybody does, but I learned at least a few solid, smart things by the end of high school, so I was happy to see that. I was also amazed when I was going through these diaries that I actually found the page where the light went on, where suddenly I went, you know, I'm not the only person in the world.
Yeah.
That was interesting to me that I had written it down. You know, that was kind of cool.
You were talking about creativity a moment ago. You said, luckily for me, my growing devotion to being creative gave me more of a center than my growing devotion to drinking. Even it helped me find a boyfriend who was able to remain fully conscious during our dates. The maturation in the of you and in the book too is interesting, because I mean that must have been fascinating to have the diaries for such a long period of time.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It's I guess I knew that when I was keeping them. You know, you sort of know you're doing it for some reason. You don't exactly know what reason. I sort of wrote a number of times, I guess when I'm older I'll read this and blah, blah, blah. And it's the truth, you do, if you were actually bothering to keep data. On the other hand, the nature of the diary really changes. Like, when it started, I was writing down everything I did, like, and we had such and such for lunch, and then we took a geography test, and then, you know, I was just thought I was recording what was in a movie, what movie I saw, who went with me to the movie, blah. I didn't. By high school and then by college, where I really kept a lot of diaries, I was no longer doing that. I was using them as kind of a support system. It was sort of a confidant and kind of a self-exploration, and also a big tool for whining. You know, I didn't really – they're not as much fun to read when you just are venting in the diaries, and I was doing a lot of that by the time I hit college. So they're less interesting to me. They're a lot about. And then he said, you know what else he said? And then you know what he did? And then he, you know, a lot of obsession with bad boyfriends, which now those you can never control. You know, that's a constant that happens throughout a lot of people's lives, boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever you are attracted to. Mm. But you can't control that. You can just control how you react to it. So you can stop whining about it as much.
You mentioned college. You ended up at UC Berkeley, a place, you say, where it was mostly okay to be funny. That was a relief, a big relief.
Yeah, that was a great relief. I was so happy to get out of my parents' house. You know, the thing about my parents, they weren't abusive in any kind of traditional way. I didn't have one of those childhoods like you read about in books where you just shudder and worry for the child and stuff. I was safe and I was being fed and everything. But they had no sense of humor at all, which was a really rough kind of situation for somebody who was early on banking everything on a sense of humor. You know, like, it was a lot of from my mother, ha, ha, ha. You know, is everything a joke to you? Does everything have to be funny? And I would always think to myself, well, yeah, it does. You know, obviously, not everything can be made into a joke, but certainly a lot of things can be. That's for sure. And she never saw it that way, and it was a conflict that never ended. You know, she died, and we still weren't reconciled.
You talk about and write toward the end of the book about seeing Lenny Bruce. And that moment where you're hoping, you didn't know, of course, that it would be one of his last performances. You went there hoping you'd hear him swear, but it basically was an unfunny set of him reading courts.
Yeah, well, I would like to say right now that, you know, it went to everything. I was I was a zealot of the Bay Area. I literally went to every damn thing, including Altamont, including two Beatle concerts. I went to see every damn band. I went to the Fillmore Auditorium every minute. And I was keeping track of who was playing where, and I was going to all of them. I saw Bob Dylan, by the way, at Berklee High School, where I sat on the front of the stage in a folding chairs because there was only a few tickets left, and they sold one to my friend and I who had hitchhiked up there in the middle of the night without telling anybody and got in. And we're sitting in the front of the stage, like, you know, 14 inches from Bob Dylan. Anyway, that's not what you asked me. You asked me about...
Lenny Bruce specifically, but I'm interested in it all.
I was only interested in Lenny Bruce for the swear word. I wasn't sure. I knew he was supposed to be funny, and he was supposed to be adult funny. I was wanting to hear that. But he was reading his court cases, and I really was ill-equipped to understand them. If I were listening to them now, they would just be, I think, pure tragedy with a lot of irony. They weren't funny at all, and I wasn't following them much. You know, it was just sad and dark and weird and not very entertaining to me at 16. But yeah, I saw Lenny Bruce even. That's amazing to me that I knew to go see Lenny Bruce.
You know, I made this connection. I don't know if it's a real connection to make, but let me ask you about it. You write in the book early about Arthur Godfrey and the fact that he was doing a show from the Kenilworth Hotel. This is in Miami. And there was a sign in the lobby. You were told no Jews or dogs allowed. And you say, one more reason I was pleased and relieved that I found the Arthur Godfrey show completely unwatchable. Early on, when the morning show, the Letterman morning show, came on NBC, it was often compared to Arthur Godfrey's show.
Well, I don't know if it was compared once we hit the air. The guy who was in charge of NBC at the time was a guy named Fred Silverman, and he wanted us to model it on the Arthur Godfrey show.
Yeah.
It wasn't actually compared to that because it was so little like it. But what Arthur Godfrey, so we looked at a few Arthur Godfrey shows to see what it was Fred Silverman was even saying. And it was such an outdated form of comedy. It had a family. And by a family, it meant a singer who came on and did the hits of the day. You know, nobody does that stuff anymore. Just somebody, whoever it would be. And in case of Arthur Godfrey, I believe it was Julius LaRosa.
Right.
And he would come on and sing, you know, a song by Cardi B or whatever he would just, you know, would be that's how it would be. He would sing all the big hits, and then there was other people who were, I guess the announcer was part of the family and whatever. And we briefly, because that was the mandate we were given for doing a show, and Dave wanted a show. He was going to do whatever it took to get a show on the air. So he said yes, and we hired all these people we knew who did characters as family, because that was the only way we could see accommodating family. I remember Fred Silverman suggested that we have an 11-year-old banjo player be part of the family, and she would come on one or more times a day or a week or whatever it was going to be, and just, what did you do last night, little Carrie? And she would say, I had my homework, but I brought a banjo, you know, and then she'd, I guess I was supposed to go, but that was just nothing like any show. We were actually on the cusp of the line that was finally changing between old TV was based on vaudeville,
right,
and burlesque, really. And that's really what that Arthur Godfrey show was, is it was an old-time variety show from radio and from vaudeville. And we, you know, this was the beginning when we had the morning show. It was the beginning of Saturday Night Live and SCTV, and they were also on that line, the cusp of people who had grown up on TV and no longer wanted cornball, weird throwbacks to previous forms of entertainment. So it was all changing. So we never actually did. In fact, the family we hired, we had to get rid of them all, and that was really terrible because they were friends. We had hired friends, and they'd moved to New York and were under budgeted and uprooted, and we couldn't put them on very often because it was too much money, and you know, it was a big disaster. So that that morning show didn't start to actually thrive until after it had gotten canceled and we had gotten rid of the family, and we were refocused again. So, and I'm amazed some of those people are still speaking to me, but I still feel bad that we dragged them into New York and then fired them, you know, geez.
And then weirdly, like, Edwin Newman becomes part of the family.
Yeah, Edwin Newman was actually a lovely guy, but that was another just mandate came down from the network, is they wanted a news break, and because it was 90 minutes a day live, if you can imagine that, live.
Right.
And so we started at 9 a.m., and so I think at 10 a.m. he came on and did a news break, which was often really poorly timed. There'd be like we'd do something either ghastly in terms of humor right before or right had something lined up right after, you know, and he would say, you know, the U.S. bombed Iran again or whatever was taking place right then. and then we'd come on with something stupid. You know, it was a very poorly assembled idea.
When you, I mentioned Arthur Godfrey, one of my favorite comments about Arthur Godfrey was an obituary that Andy Rooney, of all people, wrote and said that there is no formal service for Arthur Godfrey. And Andy Rooney says, probably because he figured nobody would come. And I thought, man.
Wow.
It's a nice shot.
He was not a nice person, but I've read subsequently that you know the thing about the Jews, the no Jews allowed in the hotel apparently, might not have been during his tenure or might have been. It's not exactly.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure.
The other thing too is that while that was Fred Silverman's idea, the sensibility of the show that was often compared later, especially in Late Night, to Steve Allen, was that your sensibility or was that more Dave's sensibility?
That was really a mutual sensibility. I mean, I was very bonded and entrenched with him at that point, and we were working together toward the things he wanted to do and the things I thought he should do and seeing which ones we were actually going to do. It was a real mutual, I would never be able to push anything on the show, in other words, that he didn't say yes to, and he was saying yes to things he thought he could pull off. So the Steve Allen stuff, we both had some very fond memories of the real kind of surreal absurdity of that early Steve Allen show. That was conscious. That and Ernie Kovacs I brought to the party. I had some real happy childhood memories of watching the incredibly ingenious surrealism of Ernie Kovacs. So we were bringing some of that to the party consciously, too. There was never a moment of Arthur Godfrey that made it onto that show. Nobody liked that or wanted any part of it.
You felt, did you feel, because it felt like this watching it, that you were, for want of a better term, the inmates running the asylum. In other words, you were on both in the morning and especially at Late Night when nobody really was paying attention and you could play.
There wasn't, because this was the show that belonged by name to David Letterman, he doesn't really take stuff lightly like that. You know, he says he does, but when to be around him in reality, he takes it deadly seriously and is very worried all the time that it isn't going over and that we're getting canceled. I mean, that, I've said this really often in interviews, but this is the absolute truth that the whole time I worked for him on all the different shows, and we actually had a pilot before the morning show. I did three versions of the show with him. On all of them, it was, I never had any idea, including the Late Night one, which was the one that took off and he had 30-something years, that we had succeeded even marginally. I was under the impression that we were, because we had actually gotten canceled on the morning show, and that was a lot of the same kind of elements, only really in the wrong time slot. I was under the impression we were on the verge of being canceled the whole time I worked on the night show, and I never knew we were really building an audience because I was listening almost entirely to Dave. So, and I thought, well, he knows. He's the guy who's getting the inside ratings stuff, and he's the guy who's looking at it most closely. And so it wasn't until I left the show that I found out that people liked it.
Well,
people keep saying to me, it must have been such a great time for you. You must have been. And I was just working my ass off and worried the whole time, really worried and thinking we were about to get canceled.
Well, the self-loathing was known now, and I think was known a little bit to people who regularly watched. But his self-loathing. Did you internalize that yourself, that you were failing as well?
Well, I felt I was failing him.
Yeah.
I didn't know if I was failing. I mean, my only goal was to be pleasing him because it was his show, and that was how you knew. You know, it was Yeah, I always felt that we were failing because he constantly was telling me that. So then later when I left the show and everybody kept saying, "Oh my God, that was my," you know, and expecting me to regale them with the stories of living on top of the world, and I'd go, "No, I was in a bunker the whole time. We were working really hard, but I really was unaware that we were ever succeeding." So that's kind of too bad, actually, when you think of it. You know, it would have been better to be kind of happy about the whole thing.
Absolutely. So you could never extricate it to be, we're doing this really good thing. You were looking at it as, I'm trying to do this for him. It wasn't the work that you were...
No, it was the work, too. I was working, you know, by the night show, I'd hired writers I'm still friends with. So I was really... I would have been happy about the work, except for that he was displeased with it. So, you know, I thought we were doing a good job. But, you know, if ultimately the boss comes in and goes, yeah, I would give that about a 50-50 on them, you know. I mean, if he kept casting aspersions on it, then I couldn't really deny that he had been out there doing it. You know, I mean, inside me, I didn't feel we were failing. But then if somebody's giving you another opinion on it.
Yeah.
And Ben, you know, the truth is in my life, I have learned that I am really an eccentric person. I'm not mainstream. And I succeed some of the time. Like when I do jokes on stage, when I used to do a lot more stand-up than I ever do anymore, I would know that there are two kinds of jokes I write. One, other people get, and the kind that only I get. There's things I find really, 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 really funny, and nobody else finds funny. I'm the one laugh you hear in the theater when at the movie. You know, and I believe those things are actually genuinely funny, those things I'm laughing at, but they don't please everyone. So I wasn't surprised when we were doing work on the show that he felt was failing. I mean, it seemed to me like it was good. I would have been pleased with it if I didn't get an opinion that it wasn't good from him.
Yeah.
So it was a weird battle to be fighting. He fights it with himself. You know, it's a hard, it's, I don't know why he does that to himself, but he seems rather devoted to it. So
is there a connection to be made of not to be overly psychological on you, but is there a connection to be made to that type of personality that you worked with for so long, for more than a decade, to going back to the diary where you're dealing with Wayne the Nazi?
I don't think so.
Meaning,
I don't want to make that connection.
Not calling Letterman a Nazi by any stretch of the imagination.
No, he's not a Nazi. He's very politically on the right side of things.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
But what I'm getting at is that feeling of perhaps it being a situation that you're looking at and looking at it maybe differently. I don't know.
Well, I just think that I was raised by a really, really critical mother to just keep trying to please unpleasable people.
Yeah.
So I was familiar with the dynamic. I would say that was, and didn't expect it to be any other way. I expected to be criticized for things I worked hard on. And like when I first moved to Los Angeles and decided to become a writer, she insisted on reading. I had written spec scripts, and she insisted on reading them. And I stood around watching her read them without any facial expression on her face. And then she put them down on her lap and looked up at me, and I went, "And?" And she went, "Well, I don't happen to care for them, but I pray I'm wrong."
Yeah.
And then I went in and took a shower.
you say that at the beginning of the book, where your mother says, "I wasn't crazy about it, but I'm not really a comedy person."
Yeah, that was how she thought all the time. She believed, and I'm not sure if it's not Jewish, but it must just be just critical people. Actually, I think it's not Jewish. I think there's plenty of everybody who does this stuff. They think that the way to be close to somebody is to be blunt. And I would end that too. How about tactful or kind? You know, what is blunt? Unless you're talking to you know, somebody who can really change your fate, and you have to protest. You know, what is the point of telling anyone something that's going to hurt their feelings?
You're have been such an innovator and have done such amazing things on television and writing. I mentioned the Paddy Chayefsky Television Writing Achievement Award. Do you allow yourself now to look back on whether it be Stupid Petrix or various aspects of the show and be proud of them?
They have very mixed coloration for me. I try to just move forward. I try not to look back on them. Mm. I don't actually look back on them much. I've never watched most of them. I'm now selling my Letterman memorabilia, just by the way, if anyone's interested, on eBay. My first auction is ending in 4 hours. And I'm giving 100% of the proceeds to animal rescues. So I'm excited about that. That seems like a good use of my Letterman memories.
And not even the memories of the show itself, but as for your, again, maturation as a humorist, of that you're proud of the work that you've done, because it's a body of work. It's part of the body of work.
It's a big, weirdly varied body of work, but the thing that I, you know, some stuff you learn to get over the weird personality warps that your parents put into your personality. And you, if you're smart, you learn to work with them and fight them, but they don't completely go away. And I have found that the way I make my way through life is I do two things. I try to be honest and I try to try really hard. I try to be in the moment and doing the very best I can with whatever it is. And if I've done those two things, there's nothing else you can do. So I just put it aside. I'm not really ever sure if I did a good job or not, unless other people are telling me I did a good job. Like, people are really liking this book,
yes,
and that makes me think maybe it's it came out okay. If nobody ever said anything to me about it, I would probably not look at it again because I'd be worried I screwed it up. So that's a warp I have to live with. You know, I'm glad I did it. I wasn't going to not do it, and I wasn't going to not finish it. But I can't really reward myself too well.
So two final questions, I promise. One is, are there more diaries than what we read about here? And if you continue the story, would you do it without the benefit of the diaries, given the rules that you had set out for this book?
No, I'm not going to continue the story without the diaries. That just to write memoirs never really interested me. I don't feel important enough that way. In fact, I worked really hard to figure out a way to make these universal, not just about one person. I was trying to open it up to everybody's life. But although certainly it was not typical of everybody's life, but I think a lot of people had some of the experiences. But yeah, I have a lot of diaries. I kept them until 2 years ago when I started, 3 years ago when I started doing this book. They ended up, the last 5 years, I've been keeping them as drawings.
Yeah.
Because I started, it's a way more fun thing to look back on the drawing you did of the day than it is to hear yourself whining, I've found. And also, my new rules for diaries are write about one thing that sticks with you that happened during the day. And if it's just an exchange with a cashier at Trader Joe's, then that's the thing I write about. And I found that brings back more stuff than a listing of grievances or whatever.
Well, this book is so special. It's hilarious, and it's also very poignant. But the art is beautiful, and the way it's put together is beautiful. So congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that. That makes me feel good.
A lovely, lovely piece of work. The name of the new book is We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Merrill Marco. It is written and illustrated by Merrill Marco. The book is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Merrill, what a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Be well. Thank you.
Bye.
Again, the name of the book is We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Merrill Marco. It is published by Algonquin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.